Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:57 p.m. That is Pacific Standard Time. Today is February 1st. And I thought we'd kick off today looking at Amazon. There are a number of different reasons to do that. The first is that it was one of the major headlines in here today that their growth is starting to slow down. They gave a rather tepid forecast for the first quarter of this year. So that has certainly started to raise some questions. The first is, obviously, that Amazon has had this rather spectacular rebound from $1,300 to $1,700. That is now testing the region of the most recent rally peak, which was around the $1,800 area back at the beginning of December. There's been a succession of lower rally highs since September. There's also a succession of lower lows. In a downtrend, the lower highs are more important because they represent the point at which people who own are willing to sell. And if we get supply returning to dominance at successively lower levels, it tells us that sentiment is deteriorating. So this is an important place for investors to start to reassess. And so far, that succession of lower rally highs has held. Now, in order to demonstrate that we are back in a true demand-dominated environment, we would need to see higher reaction lows. So the first potential higher reaction low might well be imminent because there is scope here for some additional reversion. Well, one of the reasons why Amazon has also been disappointing for investors in here today is because they're spending more money. When you're already the dominant player in the online marketplace, then each incremental new subscriber is going to cost you some additional money. And of course, they are spending a great deal of money in trying to crack the Indian market. Well, the Indian retail sector is heavily dominated by mom and pop stores, and those mom and pop stores vote. So what happened today also was that Narendra Modi, in an effort to curry the favor of those mom-and-pop store owners and small businesses generally, introduced some additional hurdles over which the online marketplace is going to have to jump if they're going to start to encroach upon the retail sector in India. And of course, India is the prize because they have 1.3 to 1.4 billion people, and half of them are under the age of 25. So when we look at the long-term chart of the Nifty index, then it has done nothing but march higher since the early 2000s, and that's still very much intact. Now, that is not to say that India is bereft of volatility. In fact, one of the reasons why people like the market is because it is volatile. When it pulls back, it does so in a very violent manner, but then it has bounced back subsequently even more strongly. So obviously the upcoming election is an uncertainty, and there is clear evidence, and it was largely inevitable, that the BJP were going to both stoke Hindu nationalism and then also try to buy the election. So we saw the budget coming through today, and there is something in the order of about $13 billion worth of additional spending and basically handouts to buy votes that have been permissioned. What is particularly interesting is that the rupee has been really quite steady. Now, it was weaker in here today, but not in a dynamic manner, and it has continued to hold the lows that we saw put in back in October. What we did see was some action in the government bond market, and there was certainly some profit taking. We've seen a fairly substantial rally in bond prices and compression in yields since approximately October, and then the yield appreciated, the yield rose today by about 9 basis points. That suggests a low of at least near-term significance for the yield, and probably caps the advance in the bond price for at least the near term. We're also definitely seeing some churn in the banking sector. When, for example, we look at the Bombay Banks Index, it is right in the region of its peak and it's been largely range bound for a year. But if we drill down into what its constituents are doing, well, Axis Bank has broken out to new all-time highs, so it would be hard to argue there's any trouble there. Yes Bank, on the other hand, has seen a defection where a member of its board is in fact moving to Axis Bank, and that has, well, one of the reasons it pulled back so violently was because of the actions of members of its board. So there's some churn within the board of the bank, and that is contributing to this volatility. And then, of course, you had D1 Finance, Housing Finance, in here this week, and that share had pulled back really very sharply on additional revelations of accounting malfeasance. And accounting malfeasance is something that has been cropping up around the world. When we look at what's happening in some of the banks and credit bureaus within India, then we've seen that some of these accounting issues have cropped up. And then when we look at what's happened in Germany with Wirecard, then that's also as a result of poor standards of governance at the board level. And the share has pretty much halved in the space of 4 months. So these are also products of the fact that global liquidity has been contracting. One of the reasons why some of these issues have been coming to light recently rather than last year or the year before is it's not generally until you start to see liquidity drying up that some of the frauds start to come to light. This is really very reminiscent of a number of the examples we had back in 2006, 7, and 8. But it is also a wider indication that we are starting to see some effects of the liquidity tightening that's been going on for much of the last year. That's why what happened in here this week, in terms of the Federal Reserve, the ECB, and the Bank of China, People's Bank of China, is so important. Because when we look at that, the total assets of the Federal Reserve, it has come down by about 10% over the course of the last couple of years from the peak back in 2015. But most of that decline happened in 2018. The very big question that's been outstanding since, and I think let's just look at the year-long chart for the S&P 500. It gives us a really good example here. When we think about when did Jay Powell take the job of chairman of the Federal Reserve, he took office on the 5th of February. That was the second, so there we go. That's probably about the fifth. And that was against a background where we had had a very impressive advance all the way from September, and then we had a reversion back towards the mean. The Federal Reserve obviously concluded that was certainly not the time to intervene, and they weren't going to panic at a 10% pullback. And that was a 10% pullback back in February. Well, then they continued to raise interest rates, they continued to reduce the size of their balance sheet, and the market did not have any evidence that there was a Powell put. And that was the very big outstanding question that nobody really had an answer to. When you think about the withdrawal of liquidity and the trade wars, those are certainly big questions, but the question of whether there was a Powell put was something that nobody really had an answer to. And that was particularly the case since the assumption had been that because he was appointed by President Trump, that he would be a dove, but yet his public statements were very much to the effect that the withdrawal of liquidity was baked into policy. So when he then started to make statements along the lines that the interest rate was nowhere close to the neutral bound. That's when the market really started to pull back, because people then started to draw the very clear conclusion that they did not have a Powell put, and that there wasn't going to be a great deal of assistance coming from the Fed. So that's when markets really did start to sell off, and we had a 20% pullback. So the pullback from the peaks in August, September were double the size of the pullback that we saw in January, and that now has been enough for the Federal Reserve to come out on Wednesday and say that they are going to be patient about raising interest rates, that they are going to be data dependent, and they are going to wait and see in terms of their reductions in terms of the balance sheet, and that they are willing to use all tools at their disposal to assist the market in the event of strife in future. So that was, I think, really what the market had been waiting for, and we saw an additional rebound. But it's one thing for the Fed to say it, and it's quite another thing for the Fed to do it. So we certainly have a short-term overbought condition, and the S&P 500 is coming back up towards the region of the progression of lower rally highs. Having had a very deep oversold condition, it has been replaced by a wide overbought condition. So it's not at all beyond the bounds possibility that we do get some pause and consolidation and potentially a retest of the low. But in order to truly confirm that we are back in a demand-dominated environment, we're going to have to see a higher reaction low that holds, and then higher highs, in exactly the same fashion that we would need to see on Amazon. And of course, Amazon is a major constituent of the broader index, as well as being a major constituent of a substantial number of ETFs. So what happens with Amazon is going to have a knock-on effect for the wider market. So that's an important characteristic, that now we have pretty good evidence that there is a Powell put. Then you have Mario Draghi. Well, he's not going to be raising rates anytime soon. And in fact, I think it's highly unlikely he's going to raise rates at all during his tenure. We don't yet know who is going to replace him, but whoever that person is going to have to be a dove, because the European economy is not expanding. Italy is now in a recession. Germany really just squeaked by and didn't get a recession in the fourth quarter of last year. And French growth is starting to deteriorate, not least because of the yellow vest protests. And the ECB has been busy buying bonds. When we look at, for example, the yield curves on a substantial on some of the core countries, well, down here we have the German and then the Dutch yield curves. And we can see, for example, that both of them are somewhere between approximately 8 years, where all of the bonds with maturities of less than 8 years have negative yields. France, which arguably has got nowhere near as strong an economy as those two, has got negative or flat yields out to maturities of 6%. And even Italy has got a negative yield on funding up to approximately 6 months. Of course, with Italy, then you can see that the yield spread tends to widen out really quite considerably when you go above about 12 months in duration. And of course, that's where the risk lies, that Italy has got a long history of very short duration governments, and there are already some cracks beginning to form in the current coalition. And certainly the League would find a lot more in common with Forza Italia than it does with the Five Star Movement. And eventually that the electoral math will start to work in that favor, and this government will fall. One thing that we certainly have in Europe is the rise of populism. and the demand by hundreds of millions of people for better standards of living. That is exactly the same reason why we had this rise of populism in the USA. It's also part of the reason why you have a populist government today in India. In fact, Narendra Modi was the first of the clearly populist leaders. And we have a populist leader in the Philippines as well. Well, we can also look at each of these populists and say that they have many aspects in common, but that each of them are clearly different, that they have emerged as responses to the individual characteristics of their home nations. So, I think that is one of the characteristics of populism, that it is not going to be the same in any two countries. And we also know that the clearest motivation for governments is to ensure that they stay in power. And the way that they do that is to give people more money. That is exactly the same reason that we have in the UK why the May administration has ended austerity and is now starting to raise wages for large segments of the public sector, not least the health workers, the police, government workers are starting to get pay rises, and that is all aimed at the next election. Because there is obviously a clear fear that if they don't look after people, then the balance of power is going to swing in favor of left-wing populists. And that is one of the clear repercussions of the breaking of the status quo, is that what we end up with are alternatives that are completely polarized from one another. They are at the fringes of the political spectrum because the center has broken. One of the clear offshoots of that is that we're going to have more deficit spending. So, on the one hand, this bull market that we've had over the course of the last 9 years has been fueled by central bank balance sheet expansion. And we have a graphic illustration of that. So that has been trending higher for a substantial period. And in fact, the advance that we've seen over the course of the last couple of weeks, or I suppose the last month, has been in direct correlation with the rebound in the size of central bank balance sheets. The important point about Europe is that they have announced the end of their quantitative easing program, but there's no evidence that it is in fact over. The size of their balance sheet has continued to expand. The Bank of Japan's balance sheet is continuing to expand, and the People's Bank of China's balance sheet is continuing to expand. Then you have the weakness in the dollar. And since the fact is that the reduction in the size of the balance sheet has been one of the clearest and most bullish arguments for why the dollar should continue to appreciate. If you reduce the quantity of something amid an environment where there is increasing demand, then the price goes up, and that is exactly what we've had with the dollar. With the Fed now starting to talk about tapering the reduction in the size of its balance sheet, potentially even stopping or moving back to quantitative easing, then that removes a tailwind from the dollar. Of course, Europe needs a weaker currency more than just about anybody else. So there is going to be some competition there for who needs a weaker currency more. And the US economy is still expanding at a pretty healthy clip. So this is not an immediate story, and we have the dollar index right in the region of the trend mean. So, all other factors being equal, this is a natural area where we might anticipate some support starting to come through. Then, of course, we have the trade war, and there is the March 1st deadline where they are looking for some form of agreement to come into effect. If Trump and Xi are due to meet in March, they may well delay it until we do in fact get that meeting. It's in the interests of both Xi and Trump to come to some form of agreement. If we think about politicians as all being cut from the same cloth, then there is only really one thing that President Trump is truly concerned with, and that is getting re-elected. And it's going to be very difficult to do that if he has a recession. And if the relationship between the USA and China continues to deteriorate now, well, that would really put the brakes on the US expansion. And it would certainly start to introduce inflation. And it would start to put a crimp on corporate margins. None of that would be particularly welcome in the stock market, and there could be some sort of self-feeding outcome, similar to what we saw back in September, October, November, and December. So now the big question is what's going to happen in terms of that trade agreement? Obviously, China is going to have to make some concessions, but what is particularly interesting now is that the Chinese are cutting interest rates. They are reducing reserve requirements. They have moved in here today to open up the banking sector to international investment. That also is going to expand the number of potential financial instruments that can be traded within China. So we will get financial futures, which currently don't exist. There will be options on individual securities as well as fixed income options. Then, and these are the kind of derivatives that are de rigueur in most developed economies, but have so far not existed in China. And that there is an important characteristic here. When options were introduced to the Chinese market, then the A-share index took off like a rocket. And that, I think, is very clear from the move that we had back in 2014. It coincided with the opening up of the Hong Kong-Shanghai Stock Market Connect, and people used the access to leverage that the option market, which had just opened up, afforded them, and they got long and leveraged really very quickly. And that resulted in the stock market going up over 200% in the space of about a year. Then you had some clamping down on that leverage. Well, the price today is pretty much in the region of the upper side of the base that persisted between 2012 and 2014. And we do have the potential for additional futures and options type trading to hit the Chinese market. It's in need of a catalyst, and the catalyst could be an abating of the trade war. So China is, I think, at a point where it should start to get interesting again. Certainly, the market has been going down for a year, and the economy is slowing. And the leverage in the banking sector, it has been squeezed out. So the reliance on shadow banking has been squeezed out. They are no longer issuing US dollar denominated debt. So the Chinese market has been bereft of liquidity. By opening it up to the global financial sector, then that represents a source of additional liquidity. And that could have a rather beneficial effect to asset prices. That doesn't necessarily mean that we won't get over-leveraged again in future and that the boom-bust cycle will have been banished, but it does suggest that this is a time to start getting interested in China again and to start monitoring some of these charts. What's also rather interesting is that some of the tech companies are now back above their respective trend means. Alibaba was breaking above its trend mean in here today. Then Tencent, which trended down for all of last year, has been leading on the upside and is extending its move back above the trend mean. JD.com, which had really pulled back in a very aggressive manner, has also broken its succession of lower rally highs. And even Baidu, which had until quite recently been testing the lower side of its range, was firmer over the balance of this week. So that there's certainly an opportunity there that China is due a bounce. Quite whether it that is, I think, really not going to address any of the longer term governance issues that China has. Those are, I think, baked into the system, and that's not something that's going to improve anytime soon. There is, of course, also the potential that China would agree to a trade truce today as a holding measure while also pursuing its longer term goals of global domination. In fact, that would be the smart move. And there is certainly nobody is under any illusion that the administration there is not smart. So that's, I think, one of the potential outcomes from what's going on right now. But now, if we start linking all of these issues together, the USA has pretty much abandoned in its tightening bias. The ECB needs to a weaker currency, and it is on the cusp of having to re-engage with quantitative easing. It's probably not politically tenable in the very short term to do that, but the more European countries that move into recession, the greater the likelihood is that there is going to be some very real assistance from the ECB. And then, of course, you have China, which has got ample firepower to stimulate its economy. So the big question that we were asking back in November and December is, where is the fuel in terms of liquidity going to come from to support this market at these levels? We're starting to get answers to that. The sources of liquidity that we've depended on for the last 9 years are still important, and now we also have fiscal stimulus. We have fiscal stimulus in the USA, in the UK, in France, Italy, India, and there is the fact is that Germany's surplus is deteriorating and their spending is increasing. So they're not deficit spending, but they are stimulating. And their spending programs are due to continue to rise for the next few years on consecutive years. Then you have the fact that there are new populist administrations in Brazil, and that you have India also engaged in fiscal stimulus. Well, this is also a very clear global phenomenon that when market-friendly populist administrations get in, then those markets are being rewarded with higher prices. And the Brazilian market has continued to hold the region of its all-time highs. And that's against a background where the real has been really quite steady. So that is starting to transform the outlook for the emerging markets. Because I don't think it is appropriate to really start to think about whether it is the dollar or the euro is going to be the strongest currency. If we're looking at something that I think David said on many an occasion was that happiness in the currency markets was matching the strongest with the weakest. Well, when, for example, we look at the outlook for the difference between the euro and the dollar, then if the dollar is losing its tailwind, then it's no longer the strongest currency. Whereas when you look at, for example, the performance of a currency-adjusted ETF, then for Brazil, it underperformed in a dramatic fashion from 2011 until approximately 2016, and now it's starting to break on the upside. The real potential here is that it is emerging market currencies are those that are undervalued and have the potential to rally in here. That the institutional weakness of the of the US dollar and the clear intention by the US administration to try and devalue the currency is a potentially a significant boon for the emerging markets. When, for example, we look at some of those other currency indices, then the Latin America dollar index has been trending downwards since 2011, and it is now testing the region of the trend mean. Now, this is not the first time that it has tested the trend mean, but if it can sustain a move above the 57 area, most particularly if it can sustain a move back above 60, well, then we're back in a demand-dominated environment beyond the short term. And if it can hold a succession of higher reaction lows, well, that's an uptrend. So we're at a very interesting level here for the Latin American currencies. Then, when we look at the Asia dollar index, the renminbi has been steadier, and it is now right in the region of the trend mean, and it was a little bit softer in here today. What happens with the renminbi is at a very significant factor for the rest of the Asian region, because everyone has got a competitive streak against the Chinese economy. The weaker the renminbi gets, the greater the competitive forces that come to bear on all of its neighbors. And the renminbi has strengthened up since November, having found support around that 7 level, but it was weaker in here today. So China is about to embark on more stimulus, and in much the same way that that will weaken other currencies, it will put downward pressure on the renminbi. So that represents a challenge for some of the Asian currencies. But when, for example, we click through some of those Asian currencies, then the Thai baht has been strengthening up for the last 3 months, and now it's back in the region of the 2018 high. The Philippine peso has been trending downwards for about 5 years, but so far it has now held this move below the trend mean. The Indonesian rupiah, which had really kind of accelerated down to the low around 15,000, has been steadying up and has held a succession of higher reaction lows over the course of the last 3 months. So we definitely have evidence in the Asian region that even though the renminbi remains at a rather interesting level, that we're getting additional strength, then the commodity complex has started to improve. Now, there are a couple of reasons for this. The first, of course, is that China does look like it is going to stimulate, and that might not be on the same of the same magnitude, at least, that we had back in 2009. But if they just take their foot off the neck of the regional economies and the regional banks, then that should be beneficial to the economy and, by extension, commodity demand. Despite the fact that governance has got some very big questions in South Africa, the rand has strengthened through the trend mean and has broken the dollar's sequence of higher reaction lows over the last year. The Australian dollar is in a similar situation. It had been quite recently trading below the 70-cent level, and now it is back testing the region of the trend mean and the succession of lower rally highs. The fact that you're starting to see some dollar weakness coming through is supporting the currencies of the commodity producers and the Asian and Latin American countries, but it's also strengthening the commodities themselves. So copper prices have steadied up from the lower side of their range, and they're now testing the region of the trend mean. Nickel prices, which spent half of last year trending downwards, have been resurgent over the course of the last few weeks and are now back above the trend mean. The tin price has been the clear relative leader in the industrial resources sector, and it's coming back up towards the upper side of a almost 2.5-year range. So that is, I think, evidence that we are starting to get some interest coming back through into these industrial resources. And uranium prices have gone up by 50% in the course of the last 9 months. And now there's some consolidation that's been going on for the last while. So that's, I think, an important consideration that when we look at the outlook for mining sectors, well, the FTSE 350 mining index was up in a pretty dynamic manner in here this week. Well, part of the reason for that is because iron ore prices have popped on the upside in response to the dam bust at the Vale facility in Brazil. So that has resolved this wedging pattern on the upside, and there is ample scope here for additional, I think, for an additional extension of this breakout. Among the iron ore triumvirate, Rio Tinto has got a very clear upward break. BHP Billiton, well, it's no longer Billiton, it's just BHP, has also been steadying, and it was at a new closing high in here this week. When we look at the Australian resources sector, then it is also pushing back up towards the upper side of its range. So we've certainly seen some change in terms of the market action over the course of the last week, that investors are beginning to conclude that there's going to be ample liquidity around, and that should help to support the global growth situation. What has been particularly interesting is that against that background, bond prices have been rallying. And today's downward dynamic is, I think, noteworthy because it's the biggest downward move we've seen since the beginning of January. Now the big question is whether this 121 point level is going to hold. That represents the region of the most recent low and also the upper side of that range that persisted from January. Now, as long as it's holding that breakout, then it would be rather hard to argue that we're in a supply-dominated environment for treasury prices. The one thing we know for certain is that there is a great deal of additional supply due to come down the pipe this year, both from the corporate sector and the sovereign. And that is as much about the rolling on of maturing bonds at the Fed as it is of the Treasury needing to expand its issuance to account for the deficit. The one trend that is quite evident over the course of the last 6 months has been the growth of speculation and either support or denigration of modern monetary theory. Modern monetary theory holds that deficits don't matter and that the only real limit on the amount of debt that can be accrued by a sovereign is inflation. And because inflation is low, then the clear argument is that governments should be doing everything they can to support living standards by investing in infrastructure and reducing taxes or just giving money to people. And anyone who supports that argument is obviously telling people what they want to hear. That is certainly one point. Politicians are almost certain to glom on to these ideas, not least because the clear reaction to populism is to give people what they want, which is more money, and this rationale that deficits don't matter feeds straight through to that desire to do that in the first place. So obviously, there are challenges with that kind of rationale. The first, of course, being that it would rubbish the currencies. That if you have liabilities of 90, or if you've got liabilities of $100 and only resources to pay for 90, and you simply print the other 10, well, it's generally speaking, the currency would go down by that 10% to compensate for the deficit. Well, There is a good reason, therefore, why gold prices are steadying up here. It is not simply that emerging markets are looking better, although both gold and emerging markets are benefiting from a somewhat weaker dollar. The much bigger point, it's not really something that we're going to have to deal with in the short term, but it is certainly going to become a part of the electoral campaign for the 2020 US election, and therefore, I think on a global basis, it is also likely to occur, is there's going to be a big debate about whether deficits matter. And most particularly, perhaps, in Europe, because it is in Europe where deficits have been tried to be brought under control. The austerity regime imposed almost 5 or 6 years ago is still very much intact. It's one of the reasons why Italy wasn't able to push through the budget that they had planned. And if the economist community can be convinced that deficits don't matter, well, there are a substantial number of European governments would jump at the chance to expand their deficits and try to give people what they want. That really does hold out the potential for gold to do much better, because the big challenge from fiat currencies is that they can be printed willy-nilly, and that's just not the case with a hard asset like gold or indeed property. So that, I think, is a very meaningful change that the we all know, for example, that the debt mountain that's been accrued internationally is unsustainable, and that the ability of countries to pay back the debt is just completely beyond their ability. So the only way that governments have historically been able to pay back that kind of debt is by default or inflation. Well, if you control your own currency and most of your debt is denominated in your own currency, well, then that pretty much rules out default. It is only a question of will and how much are governments willing to rob savers? Because that is effectively what they will be doing. But then, therefore, gold represents a significant hedge. It was certainly my view at the beginning of 2018 that there was a saucering pattern on gold prices starting in 2013, and then it pulled back and broke the sequence of higher reaction lows, and now we're coming back up towards the upper side of that range. One of the things that is characteristics of base formations is that they're volatile, and upward breaks are not sustained, and downward breaks are not sustained. Well, that's certainly what we've had with gold. One of the mantras that David and I had developed early in the commodity cycle, when the trend was not especially consistent, was "Don't pay up for commodities." And that's an interesting prospect here, with gold coming right back up towards the upper side of its range. There is obviously a natural area of potential resistance at the upper side of what is effectively a 6-year base formation. So we're getting to a somewhat overbought condition for gold prices in the short term. The much bigger point, though, is that if it continues to hold the region of the trend mean on any pullback, then we're still in a demand-dominated environment, and the likelihood is that we will see gold break on the upside. And most particularly, if we see that fiat currencies start to come under pressure. And that trend of fiat currencies starting to come under pressure is one of the reasons why we have so many, or when we look at gold in so many currencies, that we see it pushing either the upper side of ranges or breaking upwards to new all-time highs. And this is meaningful. So, gold as a monetary metal tends to do best when it is appreciating in all currencies. And I think that we're at a point now where gold is appreciating in most of them. So this is a rather different environment than we've had over the course of the last few years. This also is one of the more interesting times to be looking at gold miners. And the gold mining index, or the gold bugs index, has pushed above the trend mean for the first time since the beginning of 2018 this week. So that is a meaningful move. One point I think is really worth highlighting is it was back in 2000 and 2001 that gold miners were very depressed, and that was just when gold prices were starting to rally. And the gold miners did spectacularly well for at least the first 5 or 6 years of the gold bull market. It was at that point that they started to invest just about all of their cash flow and then going out and borrowing more money to build new mines, because mines are wasting assets. They hadn't been able to invest in new supply for decades. They then started to use the opportunity afforded them by higher prices to go out and start mining and in more adventurous places. Well, that contributed to the gold miners not really participating in the big move that we saw in 2010 and 2011 for the gold price. They were very heavily indebted, and it resulted in almost the complete collapse of the industry between 2011 and 2015. So we're at a stage now where the gold miners are back at an area which is offering the ability to give leverage to the gold price. So that's the one, I think, primary attractive feature of the gold miners, that a lot of them have got all-in cost structures in the region of about $800 or some $850. And when prices are north of 1300, then that's a really impressive margin. As long as they're not spending all that money on building new mines, then it can start to get returned to investors. I posted a review of some of the UK listed miners yesterday, and the one big takeaway is that they have got very competitive yields. And that's not something we've really seen from the gold mining sector, even during the last bull market in gold. So this is, I think, one of the more attractive asset classes that we have right now. But one of the important points about the gold mining sector and commodities generally is that they're inherently defensive. The fact is that government bond prices have been rallying because people are worried that, well, I think they're pricing in the potential that the Federal Reserve is not going to be raising interest rates. But there is the potential that we're at the top of the interest rate cycle, that it will eventually, or that the next meaningful move by the Fed will be to reduce interest rates. And they don't reduce interest rates for no reason. They generally do it because they're worried about an economic contraction, or they're worried about deflation. So that is one of the reasons that could potentially be a tailwind for the bond price. What I tend to think, though, and I think it is something that's very important to highlight right now, is we know that we're late in the cycle, and we know that the yield curve spread has been one of the most reliable lead indicators for future recessions. We have the potential that we're going to get additional liquidity coming into the market, and that could potentially delay the onset of a recession for a while longer. Eventually, the Federal Reserve, if we do have an additional expansion in asset prices, they would raise interest rates, and then that would probably be a catalyst for money to get taken off the table. I think it's important to remember that we are now in the third year of the presidential cycle. And generally speaking, the first 2 years are characterized by the Federal Reserve starting to take some money off the table and starting and raising interest rates. By the time it gets around to the third year, they start letting out the liquidity once more. And generally speaking, in the first half of the third year, you get a wobble in the stock market, and then you get a powerful rally in the second half of the year. Well, we have had a very impressive move so far in January, and we have a short-term overbought condition. So it's not at all beyond the bounds possibility that we could have some pause and consolidation, and we could have more volatility in the first half of the year, by which time a number of the liquidity factors that we were talking about in the first portion of this broadcast would start to come into effect, and that could push through to an additional rally in markets, which would eventually get taken down by the Federal Reserve moving back to a tightening bias. So that is a potential roadmap that we are at an interesting point here in stock markets because they started to lose consistency back in January of last year. The acceleration that we saw on a number of shares was an indication that things had gotten too hot too quickly. Now the question is, when are we going to see the next recession? And the things that we keep an eye on, well, they're not yet flashing red. One thing that I think we do have to pay particular attention to is the performance of banks. Because if banks are underperforming in a big way, then that's deleterious to the view or the perspective on global liquidity. And the banking sector in the US has paused now in the region of the trend mean. It is due some consolidation, and I think it's quite likely that they're going to get it. It's going to need to push back above that trend mean to really confirm we're back in a demand-dominated environment. When we look at some of the home builders, then they haven't quite yet been able to push back above the trend mean, at least in the USA. What we definitely see, though, in the UK is Persimmon, for example, has been able to push back above the trend mean, but it still has some work to do in order to demonstrate that it can hold this move. And I think, on an objective basis, in the absence of a really big surprise for the European economy or the UK economy, Persimmon is a cheap share. There is certainly the potential here that we are going to get a somewhat more volatile environment, but perhaps not much more than that until we in fact get a recession. Then we have to think about what the longer term outlook is. That obviously a recession is going to create some buying opportunities. And we're certainly seeing that the emerging markets in the resources sector are starting to firm up in here. The firming up of the resources sector and defensives generally, that's usually indicative that we are in the latter stages of the bull market. And they generally don't peak first. In fact, they usually peak last. It is usually the high growth sectors peak first. And the underperformance of the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index is certainly noteworthy. But it is now trading back above the trend mean. And this is a pretty impressive move that we've seen in here this week. Well, what that suggests is that we're probably in for a somewhat better environment generally. It, I think, raises the potential that we are going to get a higher reaction low when we do get a pullback on stock markets. That the fact that the Federal Reserve is rolling back on its a commitment to raise interest rates, then that is, I think, something that's going to help to support markets in the near term. Eventually, we are going to get a recession, and I think we're going to get a number of the lead indicators for recessions turning downwards before that happens, and they haven't really started to flash red just yet. I would like to take this opportunity to thank everyone who's written in with condolences and sympathy expressed for both myself and David's family at his death. And I will certainly, we've been writing back to just about everybody, but I wanted to just take the time to say thank you, that you're Your outpouring of emotion is I'm deeply gratified and very thankful really for the support that we've received over this week. And there won't be any comment of the day next Friday because I'll be attending the funeral in the UK. But I will be recording the longer term video when I get back to my desk, either on Saturday or on Sunday. I would like to take the opportunity to wish all the best to all of you.